In what sense was attitude toward race in state government effective?
Well, the attempt for the first, in two ways. One, the first significant black employment occurred during his administration in state agencies. And secondly, the role that the state agencies took, is the role that, that his administration, through the Good Neighbor Council, took in resolving disputes around the state locally. Now, these things are, they don't seem as important today, particularly on the race thing, because a lot has transpired since that time. And in a sense, what he started, at least, in fact, has spread considerably throughout in the state, in state government as a whole. But, you know, in so many ways, you know, the role of a leader is to start things and hope, and you can measure his success on the basis of how the things which he started were in fact expanded and sustained and carried and kept going over time. And I think that in those two areas, in education and in race, I think he made a lot of difference in North Carolina by starting some things which have been continued. And I think those are probably the two main things that he did in the state. I think most important, I think, is the example that he set for the election of the kind of the kind of thing that a person has to do if he's going to get be elected as a liberal, which is essentially really being hard-nosed politically while at the same time having certain ideals. I think it's going to be very hard, continue to be very hard for liberals to get elected without, you know, without either one of them. They can work as hard as they want to, but if they fail to balance their hard work or augment it with a set of ideals to which they're dedicated, then I think they're not going to win. And I think
Joel, is it accurate to say that he infused into North Carolina politics would be a whole new generation of people who up to that point had not been involved in politics and who were young at the time and therefore are still quite significant when you look at the political organizations and the factions?
I think that's true. It's a kind of, that's true in terms of a certain number of people. Particularly young people, I think that's right. I think one of the main differences, though it's hard to, I suppose that it's more important than, it was more important as a cause for a lot of other things than anything else, was the kind of dynamic of state government that that he introduced in North Carolina that never occurred before, with the kind of liveliness, it was associated with the bringing in of young people, but it wasn't just that, it was a much closer interface with the whole academic community, with the constant involvement of faculty members from Duke and Chapel Hill and North Carolina State and other places who were regularly a part of deliberations there and regularly in the office or at the mansion helping to develop new programs. That is something, you know, which pretty much passed out of existence with Dan Rohr and with Bob Scott. And I just don't know enough about the Holzhauser administration to know whether, in fact, it's still occurring there or not.
What were the, you mentioned that part of Pryor's problems lay both with some of his own deficiencies and also with some of the animosities that had been raised by the end of the Sanford administration. How would you analyze those problems?
Well,
why did Pryor not win?
Well, for just what I said, Pryor is a, he has no even modest constituency of his own. B, he is not a good campaigner. He's shy and retiring. He doesn't reach out very well politically. At Sanford, the animosities were primarily two. One was race. A lot of reaction to his strong and public support of the legitimacy of black demands in a variety of areas, and secondly, the sales tax. both of which really served to activate the large and hostile lower and middle and lower middle income groups in the society, which are both where an economic issue like the sales tax would hit hardest and where the race issue would hit hardest. So that you, if you knocked out and it tended to erode a lot of the Sanford, a lot of the support that Sanford had inherited from Scott, which was one of the important ingredients in the campaign. So there was considerable, and I think that, that I think that both of those issues, I don't think the race issue would have made much difference in the race with Wallace, but the sales tax issue, I think, continued to. At least the people I talked to around the state say that really wasn't still an important factor. I don't think it was anywhere near as important as the failure to organize was, by a long shot, but it was a residual factor which would come into play in the absence of organization much more dominantly than it would if there had been a real organization in that election.
But the failure of Pryor to get elected had the effect of killing the opportunity to have a sort of a continuous extension of what Sanford had begun.
Yes, without question.
So to some extent, that was a turning point in North Carolina politics.
Yeah, it's hard to characterize that as a turning point because every incumbent governor has tried to elect his successor. Luther Hodges tried to elect Malcolm Sewell. Justice Terry tried to elect Rich Pryor. And Justice Dan Moore tried to elect, who was it that ran against Scott in the primary? Mel Broughton. Justice Scott tried to elect Pat Taylor. You know, we have no, that's the one of the most peculiar things about North Carolina politics. Governors have never been able to succeed themselves by picking their successor. It just hasn't. I don't think it has ever worked. At least it hasn't worked starting as far back as 1948. And you know, that's not the situation in a lot of the other southern states, and indeed in northern states with strong organizations. Can't do it. So that I don't think it's fair to call that a turning point. You know, it was a simple repetition of it. It made it just like it made it impossible for the policies of the Hodges administration to be carried on through Malcolm Sewell. It was impossible for the policies of the Sanford administration to be carried on through Rich Pryor.
Was it a turning point, though, insofar as North Carolina and its image of being, of standing out as a progressive leader in the South? Or do you contend it still is?
I contend it still is.
Because that's, do you have any supporting evidence of that? Because everything we see suggests otherwise, it's standing in per capita income and other social indices, educational level, voting turnout, rather low percentage of blacks that vote, rather low percentage of blacks that are registered to vote. And I see, you know, except for the tradition of Chapel Hill, which remains, you know, probably remains the outstanding Southern state university, and the other institutional thing that stands out in North Carolina is the newspapers. I mean, there's no other southern state that has the kind of newspapers that North Carolina has insofar as projecting a progressive image. Most of them have fairly dynamic, fairly liberal editorial pages. But when to me, I've always been struck by the difference in the Charlotte Observer and the image it has as a newspaper in the city of Charlotte.
I don't know. It's very hard to put one's fingers on these things. I suppose that part of the difference, as I think about it, is that if you eliminated Atlanta from your consideration of Georgia, I think you would want to ask yourself how progressive the rest of the state was. Of course, you can't eliminate Atlanta because it's a dominant influence in the state. And we don't have any comparable situation like that. We have a lot of small to medium-sized cities, you know, with the liberal progressive forces spread all over the state and having considerable impact city by city. It's not surprising to me that the figures show what they show about each one of those items. You know, we started as a very poor state. We continue to be a very poor state.
The average manufacturing income in North Carolina is lower than South Carolina.
Yeah, but that's a function of the historically determined kinds of industries that we've got. If you look at what the three largest industries in North Carolina are and have been, tobacco, textiles, and furniture. And you look at the census of manufacturers, and you find that those are the three lowest, literally the three lowest paying industries in the country, and which is determined pretty much by the market. Historically, that's the way the state developed, and it's not an easy thing to break that kind of chain. I'm not sure how one would even go about breaking that kind of chain. You'd have to have some really extraordinary income redistribution schemes, even if they would work, even if you could get them through the legislature, which of course you can't. You can't anywhere. Those things tend to replicate themselves. And you know, I'm not sure that those are the factors that one can look to make reliable judgments about the extent of opportunity. You know, my clear impression, and I can't verify it with data, is that there is in fact greater black opportunity here in North Carolina than there is in other southern states, with exceptions like the city of Atlanta. I think that you have to go. I think you know the only way you can find out whether that's true or not is to interview blacks. That's my perception of it. That there is. I don't know what figures you can look to. The economic figures just don't show anything. At least they don't. They're not going to show any change particularly. We're the fact that we're slowing down industrialization, which gave us the only chance to diversify our industry, made it even less likely that we're going to have any significant changes. We may very well be locked into that kind of low income condition for many, many more years.
Do you have any explanation for the, at least in the last decade, for North Carolina's relatively uninfluential position in Congress?
Well, it hasn't entirely been uninfluential. Where it's been influential, it hasn't been happy. Harold Cooley dominated agricultural policy when he was in Congress 20 years. Not clear that L.H. Fountain is not an important influence in the areas in which he's chosen to be. Isn't he chairman of the Committee on Merchant Marine Fisheries? Sam Ervin is not uninfluential.
No, Ervin's, of course, an exception in his area.
Well, but, you know, but it's...
In terms of the major committees of major influence in Congress, very little member representation, appropriations, ways and means, finance.
Part of that, I guess, has to do with in recent years, in any event, in the turnover. Part of it had to do with the fact that we just never sent very many distinguished people to Congress, or people with a lot of ambition. Congress is always, congressional seats seem to me always to have been the kinds of positions that we retired people to and forgot about them.
One theory we heard is that when the machine did dominate, that it wanted to send people to Washington it could control.
Probably,
yeah. You got second-rate people.
Probably makes sense. It's I don't have any great insights, I suppose, about that. But,
getting back to the racial issue, though, the question is this: except for the Sanford election, on the other elections since 1948, in which race has been an issue, Frank Graham's race, the two North Carolina congressmen who refused to sign the Southern Manifesto and were subsequently defeated, Helms's race, the primary in 72 for president, the role of Lake in runoffs. Has North Carolina really reacted that much differently from the other southern states?
You know, it hasn't reacted well. The 1954 Senate race, which Terry managed when Carr Scott was elected, was an election in which race was an issue, and which the liberals won. No southern state is going to react differently on the race issue. The difference is entirely in the quality of leadership that's on the other side, and the competence of leadership on the other side. And the only elections that we have won have been elections in which there's been real leadership, which leadership that has been unafraid to deal with the race issue in a constructive way. And that, if anything, is the lesson of North Carolina politics at this point. Liberals can win in the state, which means that they can mobilize more people on their side than on the other side if they work at it and if they're competent leaders and if they don't forget their principles and if they, you know, if they confront the thing in a relatively open and positive way. I don't know whether it would have made any difference. I happen to think that it would have made a difference in Skipper's race if he had really been much more open about it and had not shunned the blacks the way he did. It might not have, given the influence that the presidential election had over that election. But given how close it was, my instinct is to think that it could have made the difference in Skipper's election.
There's a second impression I had.
And it might have made the difference in Nick's election. The problem is that Nick is mealy-mouthed, and needless to say, none of this, obviously, I'm not going to be quoted on.
You know what my next appointment is?
With Nick? Well, no. But the problem is Nick is a very, very cautious person who runs at the slightest evidence of battle. In his whole term as member of Congress, he never took a controversial position. And he never stood up for what he claims he believes in. He's not a bad politician, but he's not a great politician either in terms of the kinds of techniques that one needs to, and the kinds of organizational skills that a person has to have. It's a lousy campaign. He was always running from it, in the same way that losing liberal politicians tend to do. And so that's why I took to take exception to what you said about Terry. Terry never ran from the race issue. He faced it right openly.
Yeah, I was going to say this is the second impression I have, is that in North Carolina on the race issue, that even where an issue and even where the liberal progressive element loss, they always made a serious challenge, even when losing. And
yeah.
I think this is an area in which North Carolina does stand out from the other southern states. The race issue was confronted much earlier.
Yes, it was there. We entered the politics much earlier, and it continues to be there. The basic North Carolina is not basically different from the rest of the South in that we have a the same kind of anti-black sentiments in a substantial proportion of the population that all the other southern states have. Why, my stress is on the other side. My stress is what has made a difference has been just that factor, that there is has been on the other side from time to time a political leadership that was willing, that had the vision and had the political organizational skills and had the guts to face the issue in a constructive, open way and win thereby. But not that it takes a certain measure of political leadership, the quality of political leadership to do that. And my judgment is that we've had that more often than a lot of the other southern states. And to that extent, you know, that's the extent to which I would say that our politics have been more progressive, more potentially progressive than the politics of a lot of the other southern states. Now, in the last 5 to 6 years, you've developed in some of the other southern states that same quality of leadership, and they've managed to bring it off. And so that in that sense, the question is, you know, whether it's enduring or not, I don't know. It varies.
Well, the question is not, it's not a question of whether or not North Carolina did stand out. It did. The question is whether it does anymore. And whether part of that is because of the fact that there was less confrontation with change. It was less, the change itself was less violent in a sense, mm-hmm. less rapid, and therefore there was less reaction to that change. And once that reaction became positive in the other states, there was a tendency elsewhere to catch up to where North Carolina was.
Well, I think that the rest of the South has in fact come much closer. Given the fact that they started from so much farther behind, the question is whether they've caught up. And, you know, I don't know, that may be quibbling. I intuitively feel that there is more openness to the kind of change that I think we would all like to see occur among more people in and out of the political establishment in North Carolina than I sense is true in most of the other southern states. Now, that's an intuition, and it may be colored because by the fact that I'm a North Carolinian, or it may be colored by the fact that I know more people in this, but in the little traveling that I've done in out of the state, in South Carolina and Georgia and Louisiana, particularly Tennessee and less, that's what I perceive. But as I say, it's very hard to separate it out and to give you any concrete evidence of it.
Is there anything else you wanted to give me questions? Is there anything else you wanted to comment on that we haven't covered?
No.
What do I tell Nick
Governor? He's in Taos, New Mexico, and that was our settlements out there. And now, I'd seen the movie Easy Rider, which I didn't think was a particularly good movie, but those poor dudes get shot right out of Lafayette, Louisiana on the highway, if you remember that movie. And I'm arriving in Lafayette, Louisiana, looking, being completely, well, not completely, I'd been down here before, but still naive and full of some northern cliches about the South. So I had a little palpitations and flew into Lafayette and got a room. And I was going to stay in the room that night. And it was kind of getting late. And I was very hungry, but I was nervous about going out there. And just Lafayette, Louisiana, there are bayous all around there. They throw people in there. You know, the Klan, all the straight cliches. And until finally I said, look, I went around and did this thing in Chicago, and it'd be rather ridiculous if I succumbed to these kinds of fears in Lafayette. So I went out and looked around for a place to get something to eat, and I came upon this one place that was open that was a little bar and a pool hall. And gingerly I entered and sat down quietly and as nondescript as possible to get something at the end of the bar. And there was Cajun music on the jukebox, and I kept sort of kept my eye open, till suddenly out of the pool hall side of this establishment comes this Prince Valiant with blonde hair down to here and an Egyptian peace sign. And he looks at me because I'm kind of an older fella and I was looking, you know, I sort of had the wrong cultural identity there. And he came over and then some of his pals started coming around. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting with a half dozen of these guys and they're telling me, did you get busted? Did you hitchhike anywhere? And I said, yeah, I hitchhiked. Did you get busted anywhere on the road? And all the stuff that I'd heard anywhere else in the continent. Then they took me around into some of their spots in town and their rock music hangouts and so on and so forth. And that was the beginning of my southern trip. And I hitchhiked across the south from Lafayette, through Louisiana into Mississippi, stopping and had some experiences in Hattiesburg, and on to through Mississippi into Alabama, stopping in Birmingham. Now I noticed the kids in the gas stations right up in the mountains there, you know, the other side of Birmingham. Before that, all right, Birmingham, and started interviewing people in some of the officials and people in the mills and so on and so forth. Sure enough, the phenomena we're talking about in other parts of the country are in those Birmingham mills. Some of the same values are in there, same outlook on life that we've covered. It's there in Birmingham. And then on to Atlanta, where I watched the Hare Krishna guys, you know, in that constricted, constrained south on Peachtree Street in Atlanta. Then it was a Jewish mayor and a black vice mayor in a provincial southern town. And on to through Georgia and South Carolina in Charleston, where there are a place called the Three Nags Tavern that I stumbled onto, where you find the children of some of those battery folks hanging around with the blacks from the Gullah Quarter, you know, just sitting there talking and carrying on conversations, and just right there is a big of life. Not to say that other types of kids, the more old-fashioned kids, don't exist, because they do. It's a question of numbers. And then finally ending up in Georgetown, South Carolina, which I chose as a town where I was really going to live and integrate myself into the town as much as possible and really try to find something out more about that. So, sure enough, and then of course there was the Georgetown steel strike that interested me a lot. And I'd passed by Laurel, Mississippi about the time that I didn't stop, but I was made aware by a number of people about a strike of woodcutters in Laurel, Mississippi, and then ending up in Georgetown, South Carolina. Well, there are three factors, I think, in labor in the South now that are very, very dramatic, potentially dramatic factors, that I think are going to have significant impact on this region and some of the traditional expectations of this region might be shattered. All along, all the New South enthusiasts have been saying that the South is going to do something different. And I really think it is. I think there are grounds to see something different really happening here. And again, it's in the same demographic chart that I drew on the board really applies politically too. Not quite as dramatically as the labor force thing, but nonetheless, a shift to much more of the balance of power politically to the younger people is coming in the next 5 to 10 years. And will be showing up as they get a little bit older, and as the average age of the population continues to fall, and some of this turnover is affected. So youth is one thing. I looked at carefully there in relation to labor. That's what we're talking about. The other thing is race. I mean, just all along through that trip, I was checking out the racial thing and checking statistics on it and interviewing people in Atlanta. Some of you know Pat Waters, maybe Pat introduced me to a lot of people, gave me a lot of research. And Tom Naylor, who, when I met Tom on the first pilot trip, on this, before I started this book even, I felt something about the South. I came down South first, and that's when I met Tom, and he put me on. We talked a lot about the new South, then. It was after that 70 election, or about that time. So, youth, race, and the economic crisis that we began talking about,
right off,
the inflation, and its implications here. And I'll try to do this as briefly as possible. Youth. Well, in Georgetown, South Carolina, which I don't think is in any way a particularly peculiar place, it's a little industrial town between Charleston and Myrtle Beach, with a steel mill, that German steel mill that we talked about, money coming in, the Croft Company, an international, a multinational German corporation, built a steel mill there. Midland Ross is the company that's involved with them in a new process. And they built that mill, and when did that mill come in exactly? Do you know,
the
sir?
The steel mill?
Yeah.
About 7 years ago, I'd say.
About 7 years ago. Well, they had this strike in 1970 that we'll refer to. So youth, race, and inflation. The youth thing. In Georgetown, there are two high schools, Winyah High and Howard High. Howard High was the all-black school, Winyah was the all-white school, and then there was a court order in 1978 that they bust and changed things so that they made one a technical vocational school and the other a college prep for various reasons, but okay. So they made these two schools, and then about a third of the white population of students went to Howard, and a third of the black students went to Winyah. And integrated Winyah, just shipped, just like that. And black students are now in the white school, the white, you know, you know this story better than me. All right, I began to interview these, in fact, it wasn't interviews, I really began to hang around with the kids. I discovered their hangouts, and they took me to their secret spots on the beach, and got involved, and I gained their trust, and tried as best I could to try to statistically figure out something about these young people, who, by the way, certainly from Winyah, will be pouring into the blue-collar labor force, and from Howard High. From Winyah, they'll be pouring into the white-collar labor force, and discovered different attitudes toward race. At least 50% of all the kids in those schools have tried marijuana. I found this true of every region of the country, and no different in Georgetown. At least 50%. They have their own classifications, their own sociological terms for themselves. They're freaks, they're cool, and forgive the word, but I don't know what other to use, because they use it, in quotes, rednecks, which would be the more traditional, need no explanation. While they would tell me 8 years ago perhaps, or 6 or 7 or 8, the majority were leaning toward the redneck of the kids in the high schools. Here's how they statistically break down their own sociology. Now, it's about a quarter of the kids consider themselves close to or near in some way, quote, freaks. That means they use drugs in one form or another fairly frequently. Dress styles, cultural styles that go along with that classification, which I think needs no great explanation. Then there's the middle of the road, which is, as it usually is, 50% of the kids. They consider themselves cool, which means they're not freaks, but they'll occasionally indulge, and they're tolerant of the freaks. They do, they're not terribly upset by their behavior, acceptable behavior, but they themselves are not committed to that way of life, but are emulating some of their lifestyle. Some of their sexual attitudes are different. Something very interesting, some of their class attitudes are different. It's it's not such a terrible thing for Mary Lou, who's the daughter of the banker, to go out with a dude who may be lower middle class, or even working class kid. They'll go out. They'll date. There's some interracial dating. Get out on the beach. They find their spots to that. I wouldn't say that it's overwhelming, but it's there. It's far from overwhelming, but it's there. And then you have, which was a surprise to me, and I think has, I mean, if I'm accurate on this, I wish some sociologists would nail it down. I did the best I could. But it's, to my satisfaction, it's something in that area. Maybe 25 of the remaining, 25%, which is a minority, are, quote, the rednecks in that, in those two schools. I have no reason to believe that Georgetown is typical of all over the South. I do know what I saw in Lafayette and in Brobridge and some of the spots along the coast there and in what I saw in Charleston and in Georgetown. And what I, you know, I always ask all along the road, what's happening in town, man, and this, that, and the other thing, to try to do the best I could. Wasn't scientifically selected sociology, but I talked to an awful lot of people, as many as Lewis Harris does on an average poll, you know, and all over the country. Spots chosen sometimes at random. So,
and did you talk to a lot of the rednecks as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. There's two pool halls.
What do they call themselves?
They don't call themselves that for a good reason. You know, it's not a term I particularly enjoy.
What do they call
White
themselves?
Sox?
What were they like, really? I mean, were we?
They're good. They're good guys. I know the style because I grew up with them in the northern version, right?
Are they kids that we used to consider squares, or are they really what we consider rednecks in a racial attitude?
The greasers of the 50s?
Sort of a little bit of that. I don't want to put them down that much. They don't deserve all of that. I mean, there's some good kids there, you know. They just have a more rigid attitude on those things, and they're a little bit more like the 50s.
They drink beer.
They don't smoke.
Do they drink beer?
They drink beer.
That's who are the children?
They juice.
But they won't smoke pipes.
No, they don't mess with that.
Is there a differentiation there? What I'm trying to pin down, I guess, is are they rednecks because they've got values like I would have, or values like a real, you know, what I consider a redneck.
Who's children?
I said, what is
our definition of
children?
Redneck.
What is the kid's definition of a redneck?
Yeah.
Is the very fact that they don't smoke pot make them a redneck?
Not necessarily. Some of the cool kids don't even indulge, some of them, but they're tolerant to it. It's an acceptable thing to them. Or they may have friends who do, you know, and they don't get alarmed by it.
How about their racial attitudes?
The racial attitudes of that 25% are much more traditional. They're much more traditional, and they're ready to fight. They fight on Friday night. You know, if you pass a nigger on Friday night, you drink and he calls your name, you get into a thing. You know, they're still doing that.
What about religion?
Pardon?
Do they come from any particular social class?
I think they're more lower middle class and working class. You'll find the middle class kids more cool. You won't find pure. I mean, if you find a pure redneck type, if that's the word we're going to use, and I don't even think from the middle class kids, they're even more of a minority, I think, at Winyaw in that sense than they are at Howard.
What about religion? Do they have any ties with the established churches, the Baptist Church, and so on?
Which group?
Well, I'm thinking of the whole.
All of them?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you about a family I stayed with, and interesting how there was old Grandma Miss Jessie who ran a boarding house where I stayed. And then I got to know her daughter Betty, which is my generation. And then their son Raymond and Buddy. Raymond played the guitar and had this long hair and all. But he would go to church, but he would also play Jesus Christ Superstar on his songs from Jesus Christ Superstar on his guitar. And Miss Jessie called me aside one day and said, Raymond plays the guitar pretty well, but that Jesus Christ Superstar is a little blasphemous to me. She felt that it was questionable, but she was glad at least that there was a Jesus Christ in it, because there was, And Raymond would come to church, but it was a much freer attitude toward church. Much.
What category is this family?
Lower middle class. Middle class.
No, I'm talking about the three groups that you had.
Well, one would be the older lady, and then her daughter would be the middle generation, and then Raymond Buddy are the war baby kids.
No. Yeah,
the freaks, the middle.
The freaks, the cools, are
the freaks, the cools, and the other group. Now, what was your question on that?
Which
group? I can't nail that down specifically, but the smoking grass, like any other mill in the country. I mean, that's not to say they're all going in there smoking grass all the time. It's just that it's there in the same proportions as it might be somewhere else. And some of the values, some of the feeling about work that we talk about Lordstown, some of that is in that plan, just like in these other places.
What about the ratio of young people working? About the same as elsewhere?
I couldn't answer that straight up. I don't think it's any greater than elsewhere. I'd say it's about average or normal. Now, what's interesting, we talked about youth is black and white. And that's where that really gets interesting. That's why I got interested in that plan. Of course, many of you know that in 1970, during their strike, led by Estes Wright, you know Estes, Willard Hobby, we talked about him earlier. He's a United Steelworker organizer in that area, and he organized that strike. Interesting that he's from West Virginia, and his dad was one of the original CIO organizers in the 30s. His dad was once in an organizing thing, really hurt, injured, in South Carolina, severely. And Estes said, well, he got the assignment to go down to Georgetown. He had never been in South Carolina since. When he got the assignment to go down to Georgetown, he said he was scared. He didn't want to go. He'd had his political problems within the union. He thought he was getting sent out to the boondocks to get his head busted. And, but it was, he went there, and he started organizing the union, the election for to unionize the plant. And he began to realize that he had allies in the younger workers. And that was written up in Steel Labor, an article on that. He had allies. Guys had come back from the Vietnam War with the plant. It wasn't too hard to begin to organize them, where he couldn't have done it 20 years ago with their fathers. They just didn't, it was a different mentality. It wasn't that hard with these fellas. Not only that, he discovered that he could get these fellas to form a committee and to form, cooperate with the blacks, who are half of that local union, are blacks, half are whites. Roughly, that's the balance of the town of Georgetown. Georgetown maybe is 55% white, 45% black. And Estes came in, he said, lo and behold, this is a different South Carolina than my daddy went to. And after a few days, or after a little while of starting organizing, also Estes was involved in the organization of the Andrews plant, where the IUD came in there and helped them out. He took me to some of the early, I was there when there some of the early meetings of that, which is really interesting. So, lo and behold, here he is in South Carolina, kind of feeling good about organizing when he was scared to death of going in there. And he was finding the younger workers were willing to cooperate with the black workers in organizing. And that the fact that they were white and somebody's kid had an effect on the older guys. It broke the ice. It made it possible for them to accept. Because after all, these are their own children or their neighbors or what have you. And so the black-white organizing started taking effect. And then, of course, the strike went on for 6 months. It was actually settled internationally, that strike, if you know the details. I mean, you do. Nonetheless, it led to marches through town where the white workers, finding it difficult for organizing space, would be invited into the black churches, and they went. They had black-white suppers on Thanksgiving. They had black-white picnic and suppers, you know, to keep the spirit of the strike up. And finally, toward the end of that strike, you had black and white workers marching arm in arm down Front Street. They called in Ralph Abernathy, leading that strike down the main drag of town. I really, that's, I mean, if you want symbolic stuff, here's Estes Rife, his old man got his head busted in, out there organizing black and white workers going down the main drag of town with Ralph Abernathy. They won that strike. And the local union president there is a guy named Porter German, who's a black man, elected by the majority vote in that union, which is half white, half black. There's another analogy to this that perhaps symbolically is even more incredible, which was the Laurel, Mississippi strike of the woodcutters against the Masonite Corporation. That first strike in 1971 was an absolute mind-shattering event. Because here's Laurel County, and some of you know Laurel County. It was one of the toughest Klan counties in all of the South. And they fought like hell to keep the blacks out of their union, and they got in. And they went into this strike that was dragging on and on and on. And the inflation was first beginning, now we'll bring in the inflation. The inflation was beginning to hurt those folks because they make so little. And they got kind of really desperate. And I don't know the details. I didn't go study that. I don't know what the youth factor is, or but I what finally happened is that union contacted